So we are starting something fun. I think this picture, the lady on the left looks like someone in the church. I'm not going to say who, but you guys just figure that out. So not Adam. Yeah. So we're starting a new series this morning, and I'm really excited about it. It's just kind of these off stories in the Old Testament that people don't hear about very much, they don't talk about very much, or don't preach about very much. And the one that we are getting into this morning is called the Akedah, or the Binding of Isaac. Christians sometimes call it the Sacrifice of Isaac, but they're calling it wrong. Jewish people call it the Akedah or the Binding. So Isaac, as you heard, was not actually killed, but he was bound up. So points for the Jews, not for the Christians on the naming of this. And it's a text that that people either really love it or they find it troubling. And for most of my life, I found it rather troubling. I have a bit of an emotional allergy against like fathers sacrificing their children, you know. Even ritualistically or whatever else, you know. And so a lot of questions and problems with this. And you guys read it. Or, I mean, you heard Rakita read it. Abraham, this man, hears a voice that he believes to be God telling him to take your son, go out for 3 days to this place, and then kill him and sack. And so just right away, Abraham does that, and he heads out and goes to the place, and he takes some stone, and he builds up the altar, and he puts the wood on it, ties up his son, gets him on the altar, and then holds the knife over him about to kill his son, and God stops it right there. And it's great that, like, Isaac doesn't die, right? I mean, that's great. But, I mean, the kid's going to be traumatized a bit, you know, like... I know many people in the room have had some stuff in their childhood, but dad walking you out for 3 days to ritualistically sacrifice you and stopping at the last minute, I think that would ping on the childhood memories, you know? And it's interesting, like, I'm not the only one that feels like this could be wrong, you know? Jesus, I mean, God in the next two chapters, the next two or three chapters of the Bible, uniquely among the gods of that time and place, says over and over again, human sacrifice is wrong. It's wrong. And we're so grateful for that because we are heirs and descendants religiously and theologically of Abraham and the children of Israel. And so it's just such a great gift to us that we did not carry that into the future of sacrificing people. Yeah. Woohoo! Such a big thing. Big thing. We don't want to take those things for granted. And yet, here we have, in this text, God commanding Abraham to sacrifice, his human sacrifice, his son. It's troubling and perplexing to pastors and teachers of the Bible because it's not self-evident what the point is, right? You can't just go to moms and dads and say, here's the story of Abraham, go and do likewise, you know? Not recommended that you teach it that way. But what I've found over time in wrestling with this and growing up in faith a bit is that God wasn't acting in Abraham's life to traumatize and torment Abraham and Isaac. But God was intervening in their life to rescue and to save them in a way that they desperately needed rescuing and saving, and in a way that only God could. And a really neat thing for you and for me is because this story got passed down from generation to generation and then written down, and that we're getting to read it today, that in a way through this story that God is reaching out to us and offering to rescue and save us in a way that all of us need desperately saving, even though we may not realize it, though it may not be self-evident at first. To explain this, I'm going to have to go back over some stuff that I was teaching in the fall just briefly. And if you've heard this before, that's great. It's a refresher. And if it's the first time, then yay for you. So human beings, we are exocentric. Exocentric. It means that we find our center, our reason for being, our sense of self, identity outside of ourselves. Cats and dogs, I've had two of the best dogs in the whole world, and many of you like your dogs, but like they're second rate compared to the dogs that I've had in my life. But our cats and dogs, they have feelings, they have emotions, they have moods, they have personalities, all those sorts of things, but they don't have existential crises, right? They don't make bad life choices because they're wrestling with, why am I here? What is my purpose in life? You know? How does my life have meaning and value? They don't have existential crises because they're endocentric and we're exocentric. We have those things. We are wired to find our life and our reason for being outside of ourselves. And how we play out, how we live out, how we handle our exocentricness, how we find our what on the outside of us helps us find our meaning, our reason for being, our value, our purpose, all of that stuff. It shapes our life. Whatever it is that we find, that we make the ultimate thing, or things that we make the ultimate thing, it shapes our life, and it is either the path to heaven or the road to hell. And that might sound dramatic to you, but it is played out and rehearsed, and the story is told, and it is verified over and over again every day in counseling offices and recovery groups, and it is on every headline in our news. It's in all of our advertisements. It's in our family discussions and dynamics, that we are exocentric. It's in the quiet cries of the human heart that we are exocentric, and it is the way that we live that out, the way that we play that out, whatever we hold to be the ultimate thing that is outside of us will either put us on the path to heaven or the road to hell, to life or suffering. Traditionally, Christians would have said it this way. We would have said something like, we are wired to worship. We are wired to worship. There is something outside of us that we are going to hold as the ultimate thing, or things that we are going to hold as the ultimate things. And that's just how we're wired. And whatever we hold, those things will shape our lives. If we worship the one who is the ultimate, and therefore is the only one that is worthy and can fit in that place in our life as the ultimate thing, then it leads to life and to health and good things in our life. But if we try to make lesser things into the ultimate thing, then it leads to suffering. St. Augustine, over 1,500 years ago, said it this way, at the heart of all of our suffering is a disordered love. And what he meant by that is that any time that we give something our greatest love, our deepest trust, our strongest loyalty, and our purest hope, anything we give those things to anything other than the one that can rightfully hold that, it leads to suffering. But when we love God first, we are free to love other things best. When we love God first, we're free to love other things best. The heart of all of our suffering is a disordered love. We were made to worship, and we were made to worship God alone. When we do this, it leads to life, and it leads to health, and it leads to well-being. And when we give that place to anything else, not only does it twist us and mar our own soul and reshape our own life, but it also twists and mars the thing that we love, the thing that we worship. It also twists and infects all the other relationships around us. We are exocentric. We are wired to worship. And what we choose to worship, what we give our ultimate praise and adoration and all those sort of things to, our loyalty and our trust will shape our life as a blessing or as a curse. And us human beings, we can make anything into an idol. That's what we're talking about. We can make anything into an idol, anything into a little god. We can make popularity or having a winsome personality or exercise or eating right. We can make being smart We can make having things. We can make romance or sex or money or travel or whatever. We can make almost anything into a god. We can take almost any lesser thing and elevate it to an ultimate thing in our life. And that'll warp us, and it warps that thing that otherwise would be a blessing in our lives. Parents can even make an idol of their children. I knew this couple years ago that they longed to have a kid. They longed to be parents. They prayed about it constantly, asked people to pray for them. They went to all the people, and they tried all the things, spent all the money. And after years and years and lots of dollars and lots of heartache, they just gave up. They accepted that this wasn't going to be for us. This thing that we wanted and we longed for, it's just not going to be for us. And really, rather shortly after they just gave that up, God gave them a miracle, a precious gift. She became pregnant. And they were nervous, and they were excited, and they were hopeful. They were all the things, as Lauren likes to say, feeling all the feelings. But the days and the months passed, and eventually she brought this beautiful, healthy little baby boy into the world. God had given them a miracle when it seemed like all hope was lost. God had given them a precious gift. But in those mother's arms, in that mother's arms, in her heart, that precious gift began to take the place of the giver. And this thing, this very good thing in her heart became an ultimate thing. It wasn't just a mother's love. As powerful as that is, as wonderful as it is, it wasn't just a mother's love. She loved her ultimate thing. And it began to twist her and to mar all of her relationships. It drove away her husband, drove away all of her friends, and worst and saddest of all, it twisted the son that she loved so much. As he grew rather quickly, he became intolerable to everyone that was around him, and he became an oppressive tyrant to his mother. And any time that he was unhappy, she would do anything to make him happy again, especially to make him happy with her again. Can you see how this gift, this miracle, became a god in her life? Became an ultimate thing? Became the thing that she loved the most, but she also feared the most? All of our little gods, all of our idols will betray us. Things that were meant for beauty can become ugly in a disordered love. I wish I could say that this story of this mother and the son had a happy ending, but it doesn't. Not for the mom and not for the son. And because of this and because of other things, I can look at this story in Isaac and I can see that God in this moment and in this story was reaching out to save Abraham and save Isaac, save them at a soul level the way that only God could, save them from the same fate of this mother and this son. How in the world could Isaac not have become an ultimate thing in Abraham's life? Maybe not the ultimate thing, but an ultimate thing right alongside God. How could Isaac have not become an ultimate thing in Abraham's life? In a world where family and having an heir is and having descendants is everything, more than what we can really relate to in our very individualistic society. It's bigger than what we can understand. Abraham and his wife Sarah were childless. And at 75 and 65 years old, long past the time that any sane people would have given up any sort of hope on ever having children, God came to Abraham And he said, Abraham, I'm going to give you the thing that your heart most desires. You are going to have a son. And out of you, you will have descendants. They will be a great nation, a great people group. And out of that, all the world will be blessed. Not only will you have a son, but the son will be a people group. And the whole world, this world that is cursed, will then, I will bless through this. I will rescue my rescue and my healing through your son. And Abraham was excited about this, praised God over this. And so he just began waiting. It's coming. God told me. It's coming. God told me. And so month after month, then the years passed, still waiting, dreaming about holding his son, dreaming about what this will be like when God's promise comes true. Abraham waited for another 25 years. He was 100 years old, and Sarah was 90 years old when she miraculously became pregnant and gave birth to this beautiful, healthy little baby. And how in the world could Abraham hold this beautiful, precious little life and that not become an ultimate thing to him? In his hands, he was holding all his hope for the future, his sense of self, his sense of well-being, his pride and his joy. His sense of salvation from all of his life's work becoming nothing and meaningless. He held all of that in his hands. This little baby represented everything that Abraham's soul, this old man's soul, held as sacred. And as the boy grew, the heart of the old man, his very soul, couldn't help but being intertwined with the life of his son. And as it's happened so many times before, this disordered love could have destroyed both Abraham and Isaac. But at a fateful moment, God intervened. Calls out Abraham's name, and Abraham says this Hebrew word, Hanani. Hanani. It means, here I am. But it means more than that. It means that I am completely present with you. I am completely available to you. I am completely yielded to you. Here I am. There was worship in that. And it meant Abraham's response in his hope. That Isaac hadn't become the only ultimate thing in his life, but God was there and Isaac was there. That there was that for Abraham. That God was still God, but just not God alone. All was not totally lost. And then God says these incredibly clear and painful words. Had to feel like each one was just driving a stake through this old man's heart. He says, take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah, which interestingly means the Lord is my teacher. Go to the land that is called the Lord is my teacher, and sacrifice him there as a burnt offering. There'll be nothing left of him. On a mountain that I will show you. We don't know about the struggle and the drama and how that played out inside of Abraham's soul. There's no words that are written about this. It seems like that he just heard what God said, wrestled it out in his soul without a word. But we know that the next morning the sun comes up, the new day finds Abraham up and getting ready for the journey, for the road that God has laid out for him. Travels for 3 days, seemingly in silence, with all of this inside of him, not telling anyone what all is going on and what God has called him to do, wrestling with this stuff in his own soul, maybe praying out to God. When they get close to the place that God says is the place, Abraham leaves his servants behind, and he goes the last bit with his son Isaac. And while it's just the two of them, Isaac looks to his dad and says, "Father." And Abraham, for the second time in this story, maybe looks at his son, maybe doesn't look at his son, and says that word, "Hinani." I am totally yielded. I am completely present. I am completely available to you, Hanani. And Isaac asked this soul-piercing question, "Father, where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" How in the world can Abraham answer this question? Somehow, looking at his son, not looking at his son, looking away, I don't know. He gets out the words, "The Lord will provide. The Lord will provide." And from here on, the story picks up. The pace picks up. They reach the place that God has chosen, and Abraham begins building an altar, stacking stones and arranging firewood. He binds Isaac, and we don't know whether Isaac cooperates in this. We don't know whether there's a struggle, and he has to wrestle and fight his screaming son. We don't know. I think Abraham would have knocked him out. You know, if I had gotten this far in the story, that's what I would have done. I would have knocked him out. But anyway, somehow he binds up Isaac and he places the body of his son over the wood of this altar. "Your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac." And he pulls out his knife and he holds it over his son's heart. And at the very last moment, there is this shout from heaven saying, "Abraham, Abraham, don't lay a finger on the child. Don't do anything to harm him." And Abraham, for the third time, responds to the shout of God. "I am here. I am completely present. I am completely yielded. I am completely available to you." And God says, "Because now I know that you put me first, because you have not withheld your son from me, your only son." And God goes on to renew his promise to Abraham. And for the first time, swearing by his own self. Usually when we make promises, when we swear something like that is higher than us. And God, there's nothing higher than God, and God makes his promise on his own self that "I will fulfill this for you because of your faithfulness, because of what you have done." Abraham didn't know it, but Isaac was never in danger, not of losing his life. There's only two ways that this would have turned out, the way that it did or Abraham not making it up to the mountain. Isaac's life was never in danger. God was never going to let Abraham sacrifice his son. But for the sake of Abraham's soul and for the sake of Isaac's soul, God was forcing Abraham to choose whether he would go on making a God out of something that can never be God. Whether he would continue on living with a disordered love, or whether he would allow God to set his heart right. Abraham didn't know it, but every painful step he had been making and every act that he had taken in the last 3 days, and every stone that he had lifted for the altar and every piece of wood that he had stacked was a way of him saying yes to God over and over, yes to God. Yes to God, yes to God. And in those moments that God was pulling the choking vines of idolatry away from his heart and away from his soul, these things that had grown up since the day of Isaac's birth, maybe even before then, had grown up around his heart and were choking him and choking and squeezing the life out of his soul. As Abraham held the knife over his son, the last twisted, poisonous shoot of that vine was cut away. And I believe for the first time that Abraham could really see his son. Could see his son for the boy that he was. On that mountaintop, Abraham held his son, I believe, for the very first time. They were both finally free to love each other as they were. Not as something more, not as something less. God has set them free to love and to see each other just as they were. God's goodness and God's love and Abraham's faithfulness had saved them, had saved both of them and set them free and gave them to each other really and truly for the very first time. Jesus would teach about this very thing years and years later when he said, if anyone would come after me, he must take up his cross and follow me. If anyone would save their life, they must lose it. But anyone that loses their life for my sake will find it. Abraham didn't have a cross. He had an altar. And on that altar, he had given to God. He had placed in God's hands the thing, his very life, the thing that he loved the most. And he said, God, I will let you be the ultimate thing. I will trust you to the very ends of the earth and to the very depths of my soul. I will trust you and be loyal to you and to you alone and let you be my everything. And that struggle between who would be the God of his life. Abraham and his love of God amazingly chose God. And that set them both free. And it gave him his son really and truly for the first time. What is your Isaac? What is your Isaac? Is there disordered love in your life? Is there thing or things that would want to claim to be God in your life or claim to sit on that same throne as God or take an equal place of God or compete with God for that place in your life? What is it? What is clawing at you for a disordered love? What could potentially twist your soul? What very, very good thing, usually these things are very good things, wants to bubble up to become an ultimate thing in your life? Will you be like Abraham, who says, Hinani to God, here, I am completely yielded, I am completely available to you, Hinani? Or will you be like that mother that I told you about, that couldn't let go? They couldn't let go, and she lost herself, she lost her son, and she lost everything in making something a God that could never be God. Will you let God set you free? Will you let God set you free? Let's pray.